This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With the handover in Iraq approaching next week, we'll be talking over the next several days about different aspects of this process and about the prospects of this new government. But we want to begin today with some basic questions. What, for example, are the characteristics that define a state? What's the difference between a strong government and a weak one? What are the standards for legitimacy? What institutions does a state need to thrive, and how difficult is it to build them? Political philosopher Francis Fukuyama has been thinking a lot about these issues, in particular about the global security problems that arise from weak or failed states. He joins us in a moment. Later in the program, we'll talk about the economic structure of Arab states in general and Iraq in particular with Stephen Glane, who's written a new book called Mullahs, Merchants, and Militants. But first, what's a state? What powers does a government need to function? How much power is too much? Which state functions are important and which are optional? Why do some states succeed and others fail? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Francis Fukuyama joins us now. He's professor of international political economy at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His new book is State Building, Governance and World Order in the 21st Century. Thanks very much for joining us here in Studio 3A. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So let's begin with that obvious question. What is it that defines a state?
Well, the great German sociologist Max Weber said that a state is basically a legitimate monopoly of coercive power within a given territorial area. What this basically means is that the essence of a state is its ability to send a guy in a uniform with a gun that can take you to jail if you don't obey the state's laws. And I think that that's actually still a pretty good definition. It is the ultimate sovereign that ensures that the policy that the community decides on will be followed. And I think that that's you begin from, you know, that definition, you work your way out to all of the different functions that states now do in modern societies.
Let me stick with that one for a minute. We'll get to those other functions. But by that definition, there are an awful lot of countries represented at the United Nations that aren't states.
Well, I think that in a way, the 20th century was the century when our big problem was states that were too powerful. Germany, Japan, all of the wars in that century were the products of very powerful great powers. And I think in the 21st century, it's pretty clear that there's only one real big hyperpower, the United States, and the big problems for security really have to do with states that simply cannot govern themselves, the Afghanistans and Somalias and Haiti's and very troubled places like that.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the irony of over the past, 20, 30 years, the whole trend in Western countries has been to try to reduce the power and size and scope of the state. Now the problem in many places in the world is to increase it.
Well, that's right. Last week, we observed the passing of Ronald Reagan, and he and Margaret Thatcher presided over, for the past generation, a big intellectual wave that changed our attitude towards the state, where the whole emphasis was to make them smaller, to privatize, to deregulate, and so forth. Now, that is, I think, basically a good agenda, but it led to a lot of confusion because the state doesn't disappear under even the most liberal scenario. I think that, in fact, the state must continue to protect a rule of law. It has to defend the physical security of its citizens. And even after you've downsized and privatized and done all of that, if a state does not do these core functions really, really well, you're not going to have either economic development or successful democracy. And mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things we learned is in trying to reduce the oversized state that did too much, we also undercut its ability to do these very basic things.
You also ask an interesting question near the beginning of your book. Is the United States government a strong state or a weak one?
Right. And I think that a lot of people would say that compared to, let's say, Scandinavia or Germany, where we don't have a very extensive welfare state, no universal health care, this sort of thing, that we are a relatively weak state. But on the other hand, if you've ever noticed the number of law enforcement agents we have in this country, not just your local police force, but the FBI and the ATF and a lot of people, these guys with guns that are deputized to enforce the law, we actually do enforce laws from basic constitutional constitutional rights to traffic tickets much more effectively than certainly any developing country does.
So you're drawing a distinction between the strength of government and the scope of government.
That's exactly right. These are two completely separate dimensions. The scope of government has to do with how ambitious it gets in terms of all of the things that modern states do, regulating and, you know, transferring income and taking care of the poor. But the strength is, for any given function, can it really carry out the plans and enforce the rules that it sets for the society?
Now, we've been talking about some of the elements that define a successful state. Are there things that failed states have in common?
There's really two kinds of failed states. A typical developing country tries to do a lot and doesn't do it very well. So they run steel mills and have oversized airlines and things of this sort, and they're simply not very efficient. The real failed state problem is one where the government doesn't try to do much and doesn't do even that very well. And basically what you have is a lot of forces moving into that vacuum. You have militias and you have local warlords and simply a lot of misery as a result of the basic inability to maintain anything remotely like a rule of law.
As you look at it, and you've spent some time actually working up a chart on this, but which state functions do you think are absolutely vital? You call them minimal state functions. Which are optional?
Well, the economists have a way of thinking about this problem. They have this concept of a public good, which is something that a private market will not supply left to its own devices. And these have to do with things like the rule of law, property rights, individual rights, national defense, the protection of you know, your individual security as you walk down the street in the evening. It's simply the case that if the state disappears, these things are not, that vacuum is never filled. Now, there are other things that are, I think, less critical. You can regulate, and regulation is an important function, but you can also overregulate. You can stifle economic innovation, and you can do things that are just downright harmful. You can intervene in markets and override the rationality of markets in efforts to redistribute that really undermine economic growth. You can try to protect excessively against all sorts of economic forces, and that is a category of things that I think are simply counterproductive, and that's really what the Reagan-Thatcher revolution was aimed at.
Mm-hmm. As we're looking ahead to the situation in Iraq, one of the things that successful states need to function is the idea of the social contract, the idea that you have institutions that will function. And as you're looking at the situation in Iraq, clearly there were functioning bureaucracies carrying out some of these vital functions that you're talking about previously in Iraq. How difficult do you imagine it's going to be to try to either bolster those existing bureaucracies or create new ones where they're needed?
Well, we've seen the terrible problems involved with trying to create a new Iraqi army and civil defense corps from the ground up after those were disbanded, and that's probably the single most important institution-building effort. But the other big problem is legitimacy. It doesn't matter how strong a state you have. If people do not believe that it is legitimate, it's going to be ultimately a very unstable situation. That's been the problem with the interim occupation up till now. And basically, the only source of legitimacy, I think, even in an Arab Muslim country like Iraq, is really elections. And so it's the combination of having the technical capacity, but also the moral legitimacy to actually govern and get people to obey, your rules and your law.
Legitimacy is the real issue here, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. Our email, if you'd like to join the conversation, totn@npr.org. You can also call us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Here's an email from Chauncey Anderson in Portland, Oregon. The Bush administration has argued that Afghan detainees may not be protected by the Geneva Conventions because, among other things, they did not wear a uniform. Presumably, a uniform would be a uniting, visible presence of a government or state. My question, does a uniform confer statehood?
Well, a uniform is, I think, highly correlated with states, because states are the social organizations that create these kinds of institutions that, usually deploy this kind of coercive power. One of the realities of the 21st century world, though, is that there are a lot of people out there that do not work for states that have the power to coerce. They have guns and, you know, in the future may have much more powerful weapons. And I think that's part of the dilemma that we're in, is that we are used to living in a world in which order is basically imposed by nation states, and all of the disorder came at the level of the nation states fighting each other. Mm-hmm. But now, in a sense, we have to reach directly into them, because it's what Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, once labeled these super empowered individuals, really have a capacity, in a sense, to do things that only states could do previously. Osama bin Laden is a perfect case of that.
Let's get another caller in. Dick is with us from Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, Professor. I'm a fan.
Thank you.
My question is similar to what the host alluded to, which had to do with why are there 194, for example, states represented in the United Nations. I consider the nation state something from the past, which is to say, you know, it came into existence about 200 years ago. And in fact, if we look at it today, out of the 194, only a relatively small number would pass the definition of sovereign if you include in sovereignty that the entity must have the ability to defend its citizens from outside coercion.
Thanks for the call, Dick. We've got a bad phone line. I'm going to let the professor answer the call, the question. Go ahead.
Well, clearly, the state is something of the past. It's also something of the future, because part of the reason that you get these very weak states, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, is that, by and large, in that part of the world, you didn't really have modern states at all before European colonialism. And so the European colonial powers came in. They set up states that over time since independence have deteriorated, and in other places you have very weak states because you have patched together ethnic groups. This has been one of the problems of the breakup of the former Soviet Union, where you don't have this overriding sense of nation, and again it leads to this problem that the caller alluded to, which is you know, this tremendous weakness in the ability to simply protect citizens, because there's no basic agreement as to what the society or what the nation is.
You characterize the collapse of the Soviet Union as the collapse of the last great European empire, in a sense, comparing it to the British, French, German empires of the past. As you look at the post-colonial period of the countries that have emerged from that, from those empires, any distinction, any difference between those who took their independence and those who, achieved it after collapse?
Well, I think that one of the realities of state building or nation building is that unless it really comes from the domestic elites in the society, it's not going to be very successful. And so you do have cases of the Chinese and the, you know, the Japanese and other, particularly in Southeast, in East Asia, countries where the locals took the bit in their teeth and really ran with it. Unfortunately, in other cases, you really didn't have that kind of internal demand for nation building. And so it had to be forced from the outside. And that's where you really get into difficulties, because I think one of the realities, as we're seeing, you know, I think very all too clearly in Iraq, is that it is extraordinarily difficult for outside powers to create state institutions where they do not exist and where there's not a strong internal, you know, base of support for them.
Where they're not being generated internally.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
We're talking with scholar and author Francis Fukuyama about what it takes to build a successful state. This, of course, in the context of the approaching handover of sovereignty, or at least limited sovereignty, in Iraq. Next week, as the U.S. plans that transfer. When we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Francis Fukuyama's new book is State Building, Governance and World Order in the 21st Century. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is political philosopher Francis Fukuyama. We're talking about the factors that go into the creation of a nation state. This, of course, as we tick down the days to the transfer of power in Iraq. You're invited to join us, of course. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. And a email question from Ravi. Is democracy really the key ingredient for the recipe of a successful state, or can a prosperous state be achieved otherwise?
Oh, I think there's no question that you can have very successful states without democracy. In East Asia, you have the examples of Singapore and Hong Kong and, you know, any number of other places that have both been politically stable and economically very successful without democracy. I think that democracy is really something that is important in the long run. You can legitimate yourself if you're an authoritarian on the basis of economic growth until you hit something like the Asian economic crisis, as Suharto found out in Indonesia. And at that point, the legitimacy, I think, that comes from democracy becomes extremely important. But certainly in the short run, you can have a state without, and in fact, most of the world was not democratic up until a couple hundred years ago.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Chris, who's with us from Cortland, New York.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I really appreciate you having this gentleman on. I've really respected his work, and I guess we got to deal with the last issue of a little bit of leftover history of the theocracy in that part of the world. I guess it's a substitute state. Is that what we're dealing with here in that area?
A substitute state?
Yeah, the theocracy of the Shia and all those folks. Is this would be like a state in itself, and we are trying to deal with it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the problem in Iraq right now is that, you know, the state has to have this monopoly of power. And right now what you have is a lot of decentralized groups, some of which, like the Kurds in the north, are basically running their own state within a state. The Shia in the south have their own militias, like the one that that's been giving us so much trouble, Muqtada al-Sadr. And the Sunnis used to run everything, and they're probably now the least politically developed. And what you've got to do is really fold all of those forces into a single country. And that's really the big challenge, I think, that lies ahead in after June 30th.
And I think one of the questions Chris was getting to was the idea of is the religious factor, Islam itself, going to be a block toward democracy?
Well, that's been a problem in Muslim countries because you have these radical Islamist groups. I think that in Iraq that has probably been overplayed as a factor because, you know, looking at Ayatollah Sistani and the brand of Shiism that he represents, it's not clear that they're not going to be fairly happy with something that we would recognize as democracy. And in fact, they understand that democracy is what's going to allow them ultimately to come to power in that country.
In that respect, is it interesting to look across the border at what's been going on in Iran?
Well, absolutely. It's a very complex situation there, obviously, because there you have a theocratic regime that is sitting on this time bomb, 70% of the population under the age of 30, most of whom, you know, hate the idea that they're living in a theocracy. So it's kind of a question of whether, you know, which of these societies will come apart first.
Chris, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go now to Frank, and Frank is on the line with us from Woodstock, Illinois.
Yes, my question deals with the borders of some of these nations, that these borders were drawn maybe 50 to 100 years ago by Europeans, and when the inhabitants of these countries want to redraw these dotted lines on the map, that they really don't get very much encouragement from Western nations. I'm thinking particularly of Eritrea and East Timor, some of the probably the two most recent nations that were formed. There really isn't a lot of encouragement to redraw some of these borders. I was wondering if you can comment on that.
Well, the redrawing of borders, particularly in ethnically mixed societies, is really pretty problematic because that's what leads to ethnic cleansing. I mean, there is a huge amount of ethnic cleansing between the Greeks and Turks, between the Poles and Ukrainians and Germans. What we saw in the Balkans was really a redrawing of borders in places where you had mixed ethnic populations. The partition of India was a hugely bloody affair. And so it may be that, you know, some of the locals will actually not like the political structures set up by the colonial powers. But I think that we have to remember that separating these peoples and creating different kinds of, for example, ethnically homogeneous political entities is an awfully bloody affair. And I think people have suggested casually in Iraq that we may be driven to breaking it up basically into three countries. And I think people just have to be aware of how costly that's going to be to Iraqis themselves. You look at a city like Baghdad, it's part of the Sunni triangle, but it's also got a huge Shia population. And how you disentangle all those people peacefully, I think, is going to be an enormous challenge.
Even in Kurdistan, which, as you pointed out, has been running sort of a mini-state on its own for some years now, there's all kinds of people in Kurdistan.
Oh, there are Assyrians, yeah, Chaldeans. There are lots of different minorities that feel quite threatened by the Kurds, actually.
What about like a country like Afghanistan? That would that country be better off to be divided up among the neighbors, or could that country really exist?
Well, you know, it's surprising. I think that Afghanistan is really doing much better than anyone expected, and I think there's no pressure, from what I can tell, within Afghanistan for a breakup of that country. It's very decentralized. It was never a very unitary kind of state in the first place, and I think that the Afghans are quite contented, with that. I think the secret is now to actually try to create some real institutions from the government in Kabul so that there can be some degree of order and a reduction of the warlords. But I think, actually, there's little chance of a breakup of Afghanistan.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Email from Michael in Portland. I would like to ask the guest which existing nation most emulates the perfect state using his paradigm. This was, I guess, going back to that X and Y axis,
right,
with the minimal and intermediate functions of the state.
Well, the problem in politics is that there's no, this is what makes it different from economics 101, there's no optimum. There's a whole series of trade-offs. Now, I think that it is better for all states to be capable of enforcing things well. But we and the Europeans, for example, make very different choices. We tend to not like regulation. We tend to be anti-statist. And so we have, you know, less of a state than, let's say, the Swedes do. And I am hard-pressed to say which is the optimum. You know, I think that every society, based on its traditions and culture and historical experience, will choose to be at a different point in this stateness matrix. On the other hand, you know, what's really clearly not optimal is when a state decides that it's going to, you know, issue visas, and then it takes you, you know, 6 months to get your visa, or it, you know, tries to, there was a study done in Peru of how long it took to get a small business license, and basically it takes 11 months, 14 bribes, you know, 15 offices that you have to go through. And so this, it's this kind of problem that I think is really the source of state weakness, and clearly that's not good compared to the 2 days it takes in Canada, the United States, to get a business license.
Mm-hmm. Another email question, this one from Shane Brown at Oregon State University. What role does the establishment of democratic social norms take in the stabilization of Iraq? How is the development of these social norms encouraged?
Well, social norms are really difficult because it's a matter of habit, training, education. I mean, these are all things that happen over the very long term. And even in countries that have been democracies in Eastern Europe and other places, we see how slow a process that is. Now, there's one really specific danger that I see in Iraq. In nation-building exercises in the past, the first emphasis is always security,
mm-hmm.
and that's
and it certainly is in Iraq.
Iraq is absolutely no different. And what often tends to happen is that you create a modern army or a police force, and then the outside power, in this case the United States, because we've done this before, gets tired. There's no political consensus to stay in, and you have not created all of the supporting institutions, and you haven't shaped the norms and the values of the society more broadly, so that they will, for example, you want to create a monopoly of power, but you also want to limit it. You want individual rights. You want respect for rule of law. And this is why nation building ultimately is a very, very long-term process. I mean, it's a multi-generational process to put all of those supporting institutions and values and norms in place.
But obviously, nation building within the context of occupation is different from nation building in the context of post-occupation.
Well, that's right. There's a series and a sequence of things that have to be done. Unfortunately, there's some precedent for the United States trying nation building and then getting tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in a certain sense, in some cases like Nicaragua, I'd say you could argue that that actually made things worse because we created, you know, the security force and then left things at that and no rule of law. And that's not a good situation for the long run.
Let's get another caller on the line. And Ben is with us from Ithaca, New York.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi, Professor Fukuyama. I have to say, I just graduated from Cornell, and I've had the luxury of being able to read your works like half a dozen times before I graduated. Anyway, I was wondering if, given the increase in prevalence of terrorism, or at least the press it's getting, whether the effect it has on making governments strengthen their centers would change your opinion on, in your work, The End of History, you talk about how democracy is the last step, really, in politics, and I was wondering if you think that making governments strengthen themselves centrally will change that theory. I was wondering if you've changed your mind on that at all.
Well, no. By the way, I was a graduate of Cornell myself, and in fact, the book I just published was based on a series of lectures that I gave there. But no, I think that the basic thesis of my first book, The End of History and the Last Man, was that for modern societies, you didn't have much alternative to liberal democracy and market-oriented economics. Now, what terrorism does is it creates a source of danger within the society that makes governments, you know, want to clamp down on individual freedoms. Now, I think it's conceivable that if you could superempower, you know, individuals to the point that, you know, they really could get terrorist groups setting off nuclear weapons, then it would require a very major revision in the way that we think about individual liberties. Now, that has not happened yet, fortunately. And in fact, I would say that we probably overreacted somewhat to September 11th in the scaling back of those liberties. But it is one of those potential things out there, you know, one of those nightmare scenarios that could happen. And I think it would make it much more difficult to live in the kind of free society that we all want to live in.
Yet, the question being, does bin Ladenism or jihadism or Islamism, depending on what you want to call it, does that represent an ideological challenge to that market-driven liberal democracy you were talking about?
Well, I think that it is certainly a challenge. There's no question that this is a more fundamental and more hostile ideological movement than communism was, after all, part of the Western tradition. It came out of the Enlightenment and the same sources of rationality, Western rationality, that liberal democracy did. And this is clearly something quite different. But I would say that in the long run, it's got to be weaker because, first of all, you had people in Ithaca, New York, and Madison, Wisconsin, that actually felt the appeal of Marxism. Whereas I think that nobody that's not culturally Muslim to begin with is likely to convert, you know, in Tokyo or Moscow or New York to this. And I think, you know, ultimately, it's a movement that's spawned by extreme alienation, but as a governing ideology where it's come to power in Iran, in Afghanistan, in Saudi Arabia, they've made a total mess of things. So that I would think that the longer run experience of when these young people in Iran come to power is that they're going to decide they don't actually want to live in this kind of medieval theocracy.
At least not perhaps, and Ben would agree, without occasional drafts of Cayuga's waters.
Right.
Ben, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Professor Fukuyama, thank you again for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Francis Fukuyama is professor of international political economy at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University and author of several books. His latest, State Building, Governance and World Order in the 21st Century. He joined us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.